The start of the week and plenty on the radio, from an insight into the world of hacking to the heartbreaking story of hate crime and the grand reopening of retail. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
Is it really worth anything? Can you do anything with it?
No, not really. No, but that's but that's crypto for you. You know, that's the world of crypto.
It's a horrible thing because you don't even recognize it. You do not recognise this girl as being your own daughter. Because somebody on a Friday night decided to have a bit of fun and kick the crap out of her, you know?
I don't know the exact numbers, but apparently it's harder to get into Love Island than any other, you know, than Eton or you know, Cambridge or all this stuff. So, you know, the chances were so slim. But I went and had fun in the interview. It just happened, really.
And we'll start with the live line. Joe was looking into the issue of cybercrime and he wanted to get an insight into the area of hacking. Darren Martin is a security expert and the Liveline team tracked him down. And as Joe points out, you might already recognise the name Darren Martin.
Now, Darren, you know what's going to happen. The first, anyone that knows you and hears your name will say, is that the fella that was charged with hacking? So will we get that out of the way?
Yeah, it was.
Tell us what happened, what you did and what happened.
So... back, geez, it was about 10 years ago now, I got into a bit of bother for hacking a few things, including the one that a lot of people know about would be the Sun newspaper in the UK, and a few other things caused an awful lot of bother. I mean, I was a, you know, teenager at the time and, you know, not the...
And you also hacked a Fine Gael's website.
A bit before that. That would have been
okay. So what? And you were brought to court.
So I went to court twice over that. Took ages. You know, and it was stressful, but it worked out okay in the end. Like with one of them, there was I think struck out, and we paid like a damages, and with the other it was suspended.
Okay, and now you're an independent contractor in the security industry. That's what, and the people that contacted us told us you were very, very good. Not at the crime you committed, but at the work you're now doing now, because you're nearly 30 and you are. What's your understanding of this attack, Darren?
So with this, it's with the attack of the hospitals and then the health service, like the HC and then the Department of Health. And when I gathered, the Department of Health got awful lucky and they managed to nip it in the bud before it got too far. But the health service executive was not so lucky. So what's happened is their network's been broken into. Information has been stolen, allegedly patient information, amongst other, you know, patient information is kind of the key headline one that we've been hearing about. Yeah. What's also happened is the group involved have encrypted all of the, like, loads of sensitive files.
Okay.
And they're demanding a heap of money in return for giving them the keys to unlock it.
Yeah. Now, well, when you say the keys, you mean passwords?
Yes, they've encrypted it with a very secure encryption algorithm. They'd have a key, and then once they're paid for it, they'll hand it over, and then you'll get your files back. It's, you know, it's extortion, basically.
Yeah, and and I presume the reason, Darren, they picked the HSE is that they know that people are unwell, and the pressure will be on to, because people will die to get the system back up and running. So that's why they think they can get money.
I mean, that's partially it. The other thing is that these criminals are opportunists. There's some people are of the view that they, they target things and that they'll specifically target healthcare. And while there may be something to that, it's also the fact that if they can get into any business or any organization worth their time, they get in, do the job, encrypt everything, then demand the money. And they, you know, they go fairly big. What they also know is that public bodies often have shot, you know, not the best security because, you know, budgets aren't the best, and that they'll often pay. because they often won't have, you know, the recovery plans in place. So they know that it's guaranteed almost.
And Joe asked Darren if the government should pay the ransom.
The thing is that the damage, even if the HSE was to pay 15 million, they'd still have to spend millions more investigating and making sure that they can, that they or another gang can't just come back in and do the whole thing all over again. And that's even if, you know, the other crowd were playing honestly and, you know, played ball once they had been paid, which is always up for debate. They usually do, but there's always the chance you are dealing with criminals that they, you know, decide to go, ah, well, thanks for the money, lads.
But there's nothing in it for them unless they get the money. It's a heinous crime in a pandemic against sick people. But there's nothing in it for them if they don't get a penny. So again, in pencil, they would be, surely they would negotiate down.
They probably would. Now, my understanding is that the position the state are taking is that they will not negotiate or pay, because they think they can sort it out themselves. I mean, there is always the risk that patient information has been stolen. And these crowds, if they're not paid, they can get quite nasty. You know, so there's, but then again, even if they're paid, they've still stolen the information and such. So if there was no other choice, I'd advocate payment. But clearly the health department think that they can sort it out another way. So
what do you think? There's the number of people in our health service is close to 100,000 people working in the health service. It's the biggest employer in the country by far, biggest single employer. How easy is it? Sorry, how difficult is it going to be to sort it out without getting the codes off these criminals?
That'll entirely depend on how good their backup strategy was. Now, from what has been publicly stated, they did have backups in place, but I'm not sure if that's true or not. That's just what's come out to the public.
And Darren, have you any idea why the Department of Health were able to pull down the shutters on Thursday afternoon when these criminals tried to get in? And did they alert? Surely they would have alerted every state agency, including the HSE. Listen, there's hackers trying to get in. Code red. Everyone shut down for a few hours and see can we... How come they didn't get into the Department of Health and they got into the HSE? How come it's not the other way round, that they got into the HSE and then everything shut down so they couldn't get into the Department of Health? But they couldn't get into the Department of Health before they successfully got into the HSE.
That one, I think there's going to be actually serious questions asked. Like, who knew first? Why wasn't information shared? Because that does raise some very distressing questions about information sharing between departments. Because, like, if they've gotten into the HSE and succeeded, and then gotten into the, or nearly got into the health, the Department of Health, and then got kicked out in the nick of time. The question I'd raise is, you know, what about other state departments? You know, there's a lot of stuff that's interconnected there. You know, what with, like, the Department of Social.
Yeah, but
I think it's social protection.
Let me put it another way. It's don't attribute it. Someone breaks into my house, and tries to break into my house, and I catch them. And they run, okay? One of the first things you'll do is get onto the street WhatsApp group and say, listen, everybody, someone just tried to break into our house. Will you be extra careful locking your door? So why didn't the Department of Health do that?
I have no idea. Maybe they thought they could, you know, maybe they thought that it was a once-off. Maybe they didn't realise the severity of it. I mean, I guess the problem is that there's a lot of... when you're looking at intrusion attempts with computer networks, you get an awful lot of noise. You see an awful lot of attacks per day or attempted attacks, and it can be very difficult for you to filter out which ones are just the background noise of, like, people opportunistically having a go at everything on the internet, and which ones are, you know, actually going to hurt you. you know, is it some, it's a bit like, is it burglars or is it the neighbor's kid being a nosy git?
Yeah.
And Joe asked Darren who might be behind the attack.
So from what I can understand from what information is public is it was a group known as Conti. They've got, the annoying bit is all the antivirus companies have their own names for these groups. They're also known as Wizard Spider, apparently.
Yeah.
And they're supposedly based, they're a criminal group based out of Russia or the Commonwealth of Independent States, you know, countries surrounding Russia, that neck of the world. That's allegedly where they're based out of. And they're professionals at this. This is their bread and butter, you know, they and break would it in.
Be, yeah, but would it be, are they in a room together, Darren? Or are they all...
Oh, they'd be more than likely distributed. More than likely, they've never met up in real... You know, most of them have never met each other. They recruit... They're kind of like a business, but criminal. Mm-hmm. Like a distributed remote company, but their business is crime. And they probably have, you know, most of them probably never met each other. They discuss things. You know, they meet up in criminal marketplace, criminal web forums, do recruitment, hire people to do the break-ins, hire people to develop the ransomware, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. You know, it's a multi-billion, you know, industry.
And how are they paid? How do you pay the ransom?
So normally it'd be they accept payment in cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin and the likes. Now, back in the day, they used to, when this all started years ago, in the early days, with stuff like PaySafe cards or even stuff like iTunes gift cards, they'd ask for.
Yeah.
Nowadays it's Bitcoin because they see that as less traceable, or, you know, that's the idea. They'd ask for like, what's 20 million but in Bitcoin? I don't know.
See, it was mentioned on one program, Richard Curran's business program on Saturday. I think it was somebody from PwC, cybersecurity. He said three countries, North Korea, China, Russia. Okay. Now, nothing happens in North Korea. Nothing happens in China. And I'd say very little happens in Russia without the say-so of the dictatorships that run those countries. Well, I know Putin is elected, but it's re-elected and changes the constitution every few years. But nothing happens in those countries. They're state actors.
So I'd have to disagree somewhat there.
Okay.
In Russia, criminal groups operate with near impunity, so long as they don't operate against Russian interests. Mm-hmm. So you'll often find Russian fraud and crime groups, they'll configure their hacking tools and malware to not work in Russia. So they won't infect Russian computers. They won't, like, if your keyboard layout is set to Russian, instead of encrypting your stuff, it'll just exit and they'll move on. Mm-hmm. And that's how they get away with it, because the laws are so lax. Now, there is also some evidence that some of these groups cooperate on occasion with the state. But these criminal, you know, like ransomware hitting business and stuff is more often than not just crooks being crooks. And then every so often, if somebody from the FSB shows up and goes, lads, could you get into them lad over there? They'll cooperate because they know what's good for them.
Well, that's Darren Martin from Liveline. And earlier, with hundreds of hospital appointments affected by the HSE cyber attack, Brian Dobson was looking at the issue on the News at One.
HSE boss Paul Reid and officials from the National Cyber Security Centre are to brief the Taoiseach and senior government ministers this afternoon on the latest information on the cyber attacks on the HSE and the Department of Health. Micheál Martin will be joined by Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, Green Party leader Eamon Ryan, the Minister for Health Stephen Donnelly and Justice Minister Heather Humphreys. The Taoiseach said this morning that he didn't believe that other government departments had been affected. The assault on the Department of Health, he said, was intercepted early and wasn't successful. Across the country, though, the impact of the attack has been felt by patients and their clinicians in the form of deferred appointments, difficulty in accessing files, delayed diagnostics, and in some cases, the shutting down of vital medical equipment. Let's get a picture now of what's been happening in hospitals and hospital groups across the country. We can talk first to Colette Cowan, who's CEO of the University of Limerick Hospital Group. A very good afternoon to you, Colette Cowan, and thanks for taking our call this afternoon. Now, your group covers the University Hospital in Limerick, the Maternity Hospital in Limerick, Nina Ennis Hospitals, Croom Orthopaedic and St John's. What's the picture? What's been the impact for you and those you're serving of this attack, this cyber attack?
Yes, thank you for the call. We were able to run all our clinics Friday and today. However, we'll be making significant cancellations from today for the rest of the week. The rate-limiting issue is access to diagnostics such as x-rays and bloods, and we have to ensure that we provide safe care to our public. We will continue to do all our time-critical cases in emergency care. We'll be contacting any time-critical patients and letting them know that they are, if they are to attend tomorrow. I should say all our emergency services are open, namely our emergency department, our injury units, our emergency maternity services. We'll still continue to provide chemotherapy. However, one should expect significant delays in the emergency department. It has been a long weekend. We recognise our staff who once again stood up in this crisis and have done significant work to manage and work around. However, our view is that we now need to cancel scheduled care and move carefully through the rest of the week to ensure safety of patients. And we do understand our patients will now be inconvenienced, and we'll try and work through this as fast as possible.
One important area, of course, is diagnostics. Have they been affected?
And they most certainly have. Access to CAT scan, MRI, x-rays to being able to read the reports, and equally access to blood results. It's difficult in the sense that everything has to be written manually, signed off, checked. There's a lot of staff now running as runners between departments carrying the blood results, whereas previously we'd work off the IT systems iLab that we'd be able to see very quickly in real-time results. So that is rate limiting to what we can do. Access to radiology is very important for surgery, as you can imagine, to provide that care. So we have to take all of the risks into account and manage carefully through it.
So what then are you saying to people, to patients who have appointments over the coming days, or perhaps are due for hospital admission for elective procedures?
I would say that all scheduled care is cancelled, and we will call you if we can schedule you as time critical work, but if you don't hear from us, your procedure is cancelled.
Have you had access to private healthcare facilities? We know that Paul Reid was saying earlier today that those have been called on.
We have one facility in the Midwest, a private hospital, the Bon Secours, who do a lot of day surgery. We have reviewed our list. We are looking at time-critical cancers to see what the window of time is for treatment, and we will outsource to the private sector if required for any time-critical major emergency case that we need to get done.
What's going to be the impact if this is to continue over a number of days or even weeks?
Well, the impact is significant because once the systems, even in the next few weeks, get rebuilt and stood up, we will have to check every data line to ensure that the data has integrity and that it's correct. There'll be a lot of retrospective work that will have to be done and teams stood up to ensure that the data we have collected now, which is on temporary charts and manually written, will all be uploaded onto the system. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a significant project of work that we'll have to address and deal with over the next coming weeks and months to ensure that we have data integrity going forward.
So treatments that have already been delayed as a result of COVID could well be further delayed. There could be a cumulative effect here.
Well, yes, and the treatments will be delayed, definitely. We're hoping in this week that we'll just have cancellations for this week. We will stand up services as quickly as possible once it's safely to do so. But this virus is significant. It will infect systems, and we just have to protect it at the moment. So it's a daily review with the crisis management team here in the hospital group. And we want to assure our patients that we will move quickly to ensure that they get their care and treatment, and we'll outsource if necessary.
Colette Cowan, CEO of the University of Limerick Hospital Group. From the News at One with Brian Dobson. And on Today with Claire Byrne, the grand reopening reporter Barry Lenehan was on Georgia Street in Dún Laoghaire.
Yeah, the crowd steadily building up as the minutes pass by this morning, and as keys turning, doors opening in towns across Ireland, from Donegal down to Dingle, across here to Dunleary. 137 days. The shops in this town and other towns, they've been shut and open, as you say, for the first time in 2021, with 280,000 people returning to work. After last week's appointment-only service, this the full reopening, if you will, of non-essential retail. And the crowds here, they've been generally building since around 10 o'clock, where most shops along here at George's Street open. We've seen new displays, decorations on the window, and outside Shaw's department store to my right here, they were out cleaning the windows early this morning. A steady queue of over a dozen people formulating from around a quarter to 10, a big sign on the store saying, "We can't wait to welcome you back." And then at around 9:58 a.m., just 2 minutes before the 10 a.m. opening, the excitement there, they swung open the doors and the crowds flocked in. Penny's as well as seeing a steady stream of people open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. today as part of extended opening hours, while Golden Discs enticing people back, the music store, offering loyalty bonuses for those who buy in store. But yes, a steady stream of people here, not overly busy, but again, a real infusion of energy to the town centre here in Dunleary. The message as well from the Minister for Retail, Damien English, is to shop local. So towns like Dunleary, they're not only hoping for an immediate new lease of life, if you will, but are hoping that perhaps in the more medium to longer term, people will return to towns like this to do their non-essential retail, to get their bits and bobs. And indeed, Dunleary Rathdown County Council announcing an initiative today called Summer Streets, which will see towns in the localities such as this, greater pedestrianisation, a greater means for people to shop local as well.
And Jean McCabe opened her shop Willow in Ennis in the morning.
Yeah, great. We opened at 9:30 and the steady stream of people in the door straight away. They were all smiling behind their masks, delighted to be back in. And we were the same. There was a great buzz about, especially here in Ennis today, the sun is shining. And there was a great sense of busyness on the streets and lots of people milling around.
And did you open last week for the appointments only shopping?
Yes, yeah, we were open last week for the appointment only, which went really, really well. We were fully booked for the week, essentially, and it was kind of a nice, soft reopening, I guess, for us to get back used to the swing of things. But people are certainly conscious about shopping local and shopping small and making sure they support their communities around them. So it was great to wake up people back in.
Well, that's good news for you. And I know you were operating, you were doing a lot of work online and selling online, which I know you were very thankful for over the course of the lockdown. But that meant that your shop changed its function from being a boutique and people could have a nice experience there to being a place that was full of boxes for sending out. So I'm sure you had a lot of work to do to get it back to what it was.
Yeah, we did. We certainly did. It was very busy 2 weeks ago. The store became more or less a fulfillment centre, essentially. So we are now in the position looking at how we manage our online go forward. So we have a new fulfillment warehouse that we're moving into and just setting up at the moment to kind of make sure we can continue that trade online that we saw during the lockdown.
And Brendan McAteer of Country Seat Men's Clothing in Letterkenny also was happy to open the doors.
We've been really busy the last couple of weeks. We've been cleaning the place within an inch of our lives. And look, same as Jean, getting the windows ready and just really trying to make it as a welcoming environment for people if possible.
And how is it this morning? Is it busy in the town?
There's a few about. It's kind of like when we opened last June. I mean, you have all these expectations, but you have to kind of temper them slightly. It's not like there's going to be throngs of people knocking at your door immediately. It probably will build as the week goes on, and we'll probably have a fairly busy weekend. But no, look, it's the fact that we can just open the door and leave it open and welcome people again.
Yeah, and get rid of all that stock you've had building there, because of course Donegal, you've had a longer lockdown than most other places, so I'm sure you're carrying a lot of stuff there that you need to shift.
Yeah, we've had 3 extra weeks up here in Donegal, more than most. Retail's kind of had this hard kind of year where you're in a perpetual cycle of trying to get rid of stock, and it's fairly difficult to get rid of new stock as well. So, look, we never really got an opportunity to Christmas sale. So I'd say most places will just almost open with their Christmas sale. It just happens to be in the middle of May. But look, as long as we're open, Claire, to be honest, that's all that really matters. It's just a privilege to have your door open again.
Brendan McAteer on Today with Claire Byrne. And in the morning, hate crime, intolerance to difference and where that can lead in a frenzy of violence. After a storyline in the British soap opera Coronation Street featured a couple viciously attacked for being Goths, it started a debate on these sorts of crimes. And if only these storylines were confined to the world of drama and fiction. Unfortunately, this story was based on the real-life attack on 20-year-old Sophie Lancaster and her boyfriend in 2007. And Ryan Tuberty was talking to Sophie's mother, Sylvia, in the morning.
Well, she was only a little girl, really. About 5'2", very slim. Mm-hmm. Obviously dyed black hair, lots of piercings. You'd notice her, you know, if you saw her on the street.
Yeah.
And she was funny, she'd very intelligent, and I loved nothing better than reading. I mean, she'd always a book in her hand, to the extent that she once walked into a lamppost because she was reading walking up the road.
Okay.
I know, she was funny.
Yeah.
And, yeah, she just was a nice young woman, really. Yeah.
And what sort of music was she into, Sylvia?
Oh, Lord. Marilyn Manson.
Oh, yeah.
Cradle of Filth. Evanescence, which is quite operatic.
Yeah.
Metal.
Yeah.
Emily Autumn, she liked her. She liked all music, really, if truth be told.
And if you could describe her physically walking down the street, what could I expect to see?
Well, she'd be little, and she'd have this black hair, and she'd probably be wearing... She used to wear a lot of plaid pants, Doc Martens.
Yeah.
She'd probably have a black jacket on, plenty of makeup. She used makeup all the time, actually. And she'd got dreadlocks and big, thick hair.
You see, I love people. I love people like this because they know who they are and they're comfortable being different, and it should be a badge of honour, you know. But yet,
yes.
So many people swim with the same shoal and run with the same hounds, and they don't get it. And they, other people like Sophie, did she get much by way of side comment or snide remarks?
Well, she was fine at school. She didn't get bullied at school.
Great.
And that's because I think she was so quiet. She would sit at the back in a classroom and you wouldn't know she was there, sort of thing.
Okay.
But I'd been out with Sophie and heard people's comments later. You know, you'd hear people go, oh, look at the state of that. Who does she think she is?
Mm.
What does she look like? And very often, even, you'd see people that would recoil.
Yeah.
From her. And you'd, it's not nice at all to watch.
No, but you probably know this now, Sylvia, that people are afraid of people who dare to dream and dare to be themselves.
Yes, very much. But it's that difference that frightens them.
Exactly.
Because they don't understand. And instead of celebrating difference between people, which we should be doing,
yes,
they're sort of fighting against it, which is very sad.
And inevitably, Ryan had to ask Sylvia about the day of the attack.
I'm going to bring you to that horrible, difficult day of the 11th of August 2007. And Sophie was 20 years of age. She was with her boyfriend. What happened?
Sophie and Rob apparently had been out at a party. They weren't drunk. They had been drinking. They set off to walk home beautiful summer's evening. And they stopped at a local garage to get some cigarettes and some money. And bear in mind, they were only 20 minutes away from home. We met two young boys, one that they'd met them before. One said, look at the state of them, I don't want anything to do with them, and walked off. And the other one, I don't know why, and we saw Sophie and Rob, went with this young man round the corner to meet a group of young females, 14-year-old, 15-year-old females. They went with this group of young females into a local skate park. Sophie and Rob had only been in there 2 minutes. Five young boys come in. What do? They get Rob and they jump and stamp on his head and face off the skate ramp. And Sophie went to help. She's cradling his head in her lap and they then turn and attack her.
Five boys.
Yeah.
Attacking her in a way that is essentially just boots and shoes and runners and trainers and just over and over again.
Absolutely, yeah.
What do you know, having pieced it together, what happened? Did anyone intervene? Do we know anything about circumstances around this as this attack was happening?
I'm just being really honest here, and I'll say it till the day I die. There was far more involvement than ever been accepted, I think. What happened was one young boy tried to help. There were up to 40 young kids in that park that night. So it's all a bit wishy-washy, really, because okay. Sophie seems to disappear. Nobody seems to see her. So it's very strange.
You know, as a father of daughters, I'm trying to figure out how you coped with that in terms of being told about what happened. I presume you tried not to let yourself go there too often.
Yeah, that's quite true. That's quite true. And what happens is, Ryan, I know everybody deals with things differently.
Yeah.
But I was so angry. And you've got to do something with that. You can't live with that anger forever, so you've got to let that go, but use it really for starting a charity up, and that's what happens.
If we go back to the point where Sophie was left for dead, essentially, in that park.
Yeah.
And you started getting, I presume, phone calls to say, listen, something terrible has happened. And you realised, OK, now it's time to... It's a vigil in hospital. How many days were you in hospital with Sophie?
13.
And how would you describe her in hospital at that point?
She just wasn't there, was she? You know, at the end of the day, your body's only a shell. It's a really strange thing. I've never seen it before, obviously. But 1 second, 1 minute, she's there, and you can see that she's there. And the next minute, she's gone. And you know that there's nobody there now. That's a bit strange. But she sort of blew up. She was full of water, really. Her body had stopped draining, I think. And she obviously brain damaged. And never woke up from the coma.
Do you recall going in to see her that first time? And can you tell?
Oh God, yeah.
Can you tell me? I don't want to upset you either, Sylvia. So
no.
Tell me as much as you can, but don't go upsetting yourself.
I can remember going. You know, Sophie's dad and her brother, and you just walk in, you know, and it's a horrible thing because you don't even recognise her. You do not recognise this girl as being your own daughter. Because somebody on a Friday night decided to have a bit of fun and kick the crap out of her, you know? And I've never seen anybody who's been beaten up either. So there's all this bruising and her head was massive, her head was swollen like a big football. And she's only a tiny little face, but it was all very strange. Oh, you're helpless, you know, because there's nothing you can do. You can't hold them, you can't touch them, you've just got to stand back and watch what's going on.
What did you do, Sylvia, with Sophie in the 13 days she was on life support machine? Did you talk to her? Did you read with her? Did you...
Oh, yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I sat and read Harry Potter to her because that was her favourite book. And waxed her hair for her, you know, because you have to wax dreadlocks.
Mm.
But read to her mostly. Because that's what she would have wanted. Oh, and played music to her as well.
Of course. And you had those 13 long days and long nights, and I suppose it came to a point where the medical people had to say to you, Sylvia, what would you like us to do now?
Yes, yeah. I wanted them to turn those machines off. You know, you can tell there's no hope, there's nothing there, there's no brain left. What is the point? So, so we made that decision and they turned the machines off the day after.
You said goodbye?
Yes, yeah.
And
it only took 20 minutes once those machines were off.
And then you go home and try to process what the hell happened in your life and the cruelty of it.
Yeah.
Are you still processing?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, every day. You wonder why, you know.
Yeah.
What did those boys think they were playing at? Why did they think that this were acceptable? And then the other side of it is, which is a horrible thing to say, but I often think, you know, Sophie, why didn't you run? Why didn't you just run? You know, I don't think they would have gone after her then. But she chose to do what she chose to do.
Imagine
and you've got to be proud of that.
Mm.
none of them five boys will ever be as strong as my daughter. Never.
And Ryan asked Sylvia about bringing the boys who killed Sophie to justice.
Five young men stood trial for what was a hate crime. We'll talk about that in a second. The judge condemned the attack as feral thuggery. And yeah. He jailed Ryan Herbert and Brendan Harris for murder. Was there any class of justice, do you think, for you at that point, Sylvia? Or was it just too little, too late?
No. Because it was classed as a hate crime, that allowed Judge Russell to tighten it up as tight as he could. Because otherwise, because of their ages, they would have only got 10 years, probably. So we were glad that he said, yes, this is a hate crime. He used Section 146, which is a hate crime legislation. Mm. He used IPPs, which is in the interest of public protection. So although he gave him 16 years and whatever, he could have served longer than that. He did the best he could, to be honest.
And you now put your heart and soul, and with that, Sophie's legacy, into your work, which involves talking about hate crime and talking about what happened to Sophie. What is the message you bring to schools, the message you bring to people like our listeners this morning?
Biggest one, obviously, is education. Being in there with young people. And it's about raising their levels of consciousness, really.
Yeah.
You decide on a Friday night when you're drunk and whatever else to kick somebody's head in. This is what happens. It's not like a video game. You don't bounce back up. This is the reality of it. And it's letting young people know the reality of things, the reality of things that go on. But very often, bless them, they don't think. And it's very difficult, isn't it, to put old heads on young shoulders, and that's the truth. And it's about just talking to them, you know, I'm talking about prejudice and about intolerance for other people, you know, about celebrate. And it's been very effective, actually. It's interesting. You can see the young people and the lights are switching on, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't do any better than that. It's the truth. And if we only change one person's thought pattern in a day, that's fine.
What you're doing is so important, and I think it keeps Sophie's story alive through this kindness that you offer in terms of trying to tell the next generation that they have to be more careful and thoughtful and more tolerant. When the Coronation Street people came knocking on your door saying, can we channel your story into our programme, how did you feel about that?
I thought they were joking at first. I thought somebody had sent us a silly email. And then when I realised, I thought, oh, I'd better go and talk to them and see what they're planning on doing.
Good.
So that's what we did. We went down to the studios, because we don't live very far, actually, from the Corrie studios. So went down to talk to the director, some writers, researchers, and we discussed what they wanted to do, what we're thinking about doing, and what was my input into that. So it was quite interesting, actually.
Yeah. And did you watch it, or was it too much?
I've watched some bits and bobs of it, but I don't feel a need to watch it all.
And isn't it the case, though, that because of you and your family's generosity with the storytelling in order to, for us to learn as society, as human beings, that the fact that Sophie's story was channeled, as I say, as opposed to copied by Coronation Street, has got certainly the UK and now over in the Republic of Ireland here talking about this as an issue. So I think there's something very positive to be taken from something very awful.
Yes, no, you're right. You know, once she dies, you then have a platform to work from, which sounds a bit weird. But politicians and police, etc., will listen to you, which you don't normally get, do you?
No.
But because of the situation that you've been through, they do listen. And you can make a change, actually. She's not something I've ever thought was possible, but you can.
She's some woman. That's Sylvia Lancaster remembering her daughter Sophie on the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on the Ray Darcy Show, Brenda was sitting in for Ray and she was talking to Love Island's Dr. Alex George.
Now, Dr. Alex George is no stranger to listeners. He shot fame in 2018 when he was one of the contestants on Love Island Alex is an emergency doctor in the NHS and he's written a book, Live Well Every Day, Your Plan for a Happy Body and Mind. And he's on the line now. I wish you were in studio. Hello, Alex. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I wish I was in studio too. Those are the good old days, weren't they? We could sit around, have a cup of tea and a chat and all that. But thank you so much for having me on the show nonetheless.
Not at all. Well, at least you're a little step further than us in the UK because you can go inside and have a coffee and a sandwich and a pint if you want. Have you done any of that yet?
Yeah, it's kind of, it feels a bit odd really. I mean, all the steps and things that are happening. I actually had my first coffee inside today, and it does feel a bit odd, you know. It does feel a bit odd, and I've talked about this before, you know, and I know things are slightly different out there, but you know, following very similar processes at some point, I'm sure. And it's the milestones are good. I mean, it's good to see these things happening, but I think for everyone, what I say is don't see it as something you have to hit. You know, if you're not ready to go into a busy place, that's absolutely fine. And, you know, I'm not, certainly not rushing to a busy pub, I don't think. That's personally my feelings.
Yeah, well, I suppose more than anybody, you know, you would have been right at the front line during that crisis in the NHS and just case upon case coming through. I presume you saw things that you never thought you'd ever have to see. No training would prepare you for it.
No, and in fact, not even just, you know, because obviously I graduated in 2015 and I've been working since then as an A&E doctor. But, you know, some of my consultants have been working for 25, 30 years and they've never, ever seen anything like it before. You know, no kind of training really prepares you for what has happened. And it's just been, you know, it's been the most surreal year and a bit, really, you know, what's happened. And I think it's been very, very hard. But, you know, I'm very glad that actually, as you know, all the doctors, the nurses, all the carers, everyone in the hospitals and outside have really pulled together, and the communities as well. I think that's what's got us through. And actually, when you look at, you know, all the training in the world could have, you know, you can help and things, but, you know, actually it's the community spirit, the team spirit and the togetherness. That's what actually has got us through.
Very much so. And, you know, I'm just thinking there is over, I think, 30,000 Irish medical people working in the NHS. So, you know, I presume they've worked all hours, couldn't get home Christmases, all of that. So, and I suppose you've seen the toll it's taken on the staff itself within the NHS, trying to do their jobs and working those long shifts and everything.
Absolutely. And I've got some very good friends of mine that are Irish that work in Lewisham Hospital in London where I work. And, you know, many people have really struggled to get home and get back to their families. And obviously the rules changing, particularly, you know, over here before Christmas. But the impact is huge. I mean, on the mental health of all the staff. And I think we're very concerned about increased rates of burnout. There's concerns about compassion fatigue, rates of anxiety and depression we believe are on the rise. And, you know, it's difficult because we can run on adrenaline, but it only lasts so long. And I think it's been a very, very, very long, you know, marathon, an ultra marathon of the pandemic, really. Of course, you know, the fact that we're coming out now is a huge boost. But I think it's very important we focus on the mental health of our staff afterwards, because actually, you know, over there, over here, you know, around the world, you know, doctors and nurses are overstretched. I think that's just a universal thing that we know. And we have to go back, you know, now that this is done, doesn't mean the job of the doctors and the nurses have stopped. You know, it's if anything, we've kind of got to catch up on a lot of the things that have happened, because, of course, we know some people avoided hospitals. There's a lot of people who haven't had operations that need to have their operations. So, you know, the pressures, I don't think, will fade. They will stay high.
Now, I am going to talk to you about your book in a second, but I'm just going to take a little sip of my Love Ireland water bottle here.
is it the proper one?
It is the proper one. Oh, absolutely. It is. Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, I watched you. I was part of a couple of WhatsApp groups. I really enjoyed it. But I can't believe that you didn't audition, that they sought you out. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's true. I don't know why. You know, to this day, I couldn't tell you why. I had 200 followers, not 200,000, not 20,000, 200 followers on Instagram. And they messaged me and said, look, we'd love to have a call. And I thought it was a prank message, you know, my friends having a wind up. So, you know, it took me a while to believe it. But, you know, it's one of those things where I actually sat down with my consultants and Dr. Anna, actually, and she said to me, listen, you know, why don't you go to the interview? It's something so different. You know, why not? You know, why can't doctors do this? Just because you're a doctor, you still have relationships, you still have your own personal life, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. So I went to an interview, and just for the fun, really, you know, just a life experience. And, you know, you don't really honestly expect this going to happen. I don't know the exact numbers, but apparently it's harder to get into Love Island than any other, you know, than Eton or you know, Cambridge or all this stuff. So, you know, the chances were so slim. But I went and had fun in the interview and chatted to everyone, and it just happened, really. It just all followed on from there.
Dr. Alex George with Brenda Donoghue in the afternoon. Now, cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and Dogecoin are in the spotlight after Elon Musk recently spoke about them. Here he is from Saturday Night Live.
But what is Dogecoin?
Well, it was created in 2013 and has a circulating supply of 117 billion coins, of which 113 billion have already been mined.
Right, cool. So what is Dogecoin?
Yeah, like I said, it's a digital currency.
Like, okay, for instance, this is a dollar, right? It's real.
Say sorta. Yeah, sorta okay. Real. Yeah.
So what is Dogecoin?
About as real as that dollar.
Now, Colin, are you making any sense of this?
Me? Well, I've actually been reading a lot about it, yeah. And I'm trying to diversify my investment portfolio. Mm-hmm. My question is, what is Dogecoin?
I'm glad you asked.
It's a good question.
Well, it's the future of currency. It's an unstoppable financial vehicle that's going to take over the world.
I get that, but what is it, man?
I keep telling you, it's a cryptocurrency you can trade for conventional money.
Oh, so it's a hustle.
Yeah, it's a hustle.
Why didn't you say that, man?
And just after that aired, Dogecoin lost a third of its price. So finance correspondent Sean Keyes was talking to Claire Byrne.
What is Dogecoin, Sean?
Dogecoin is a crypto. What makes it sort of interesting relative to other cryptos is that it was created as a joke. Okay. There's a lot of cryptos out there, especially back in 2013, lots of cryptos were being created, and there was sort of a gold rush, and there was a lot of hype about crypto technology. And all the other coins were taking themselves very seriously, and they had big grandiose plans how they were going to like upend the financial system, and they were going to take over this and that. And Dogecoin sort of looked at all those guys and said, well, I'm going to make crypto. I'm going to develop it in 2 hours. The symbol of it is going to be a sort of a gormless looking Japanese dog. It's going to have like a silly Comic Sans font. And the documentation is going to be in sort of pigeon doggy English. I'm just going to take the mick out of this whole thing. And so he created it, and that was fine. Everyone had a good laugh, and it was sort of forgotten about. That was 2013, so that was 8 years ago. Until earlier this year, Elon Musk decides out of the blue that he wants to anoint Dogecoin as the next big thing.
Okay, so it stops being a joke and suddenly it's worth $50 billion.
Oh, yeah. So it peaked at $90 billion. And after his Saturday Night Live event where he sort of turned on it, next thing it's fallen back to $50 billion. So it went from zero to $90 billion to something like $30 billion in a short space of time.
Okay. And is it really worth anything? Can you do anything with it?
No, not really. No. But that's but that's crypto for you, you know. That's the world of crypto. I mean it's crypto. Dogecoin is interesting because it's like a very extreme example of the entire crypto space. You know, there's two ways that people look at crypto. There's two sort of competing narratives, right? And on one hand, you've got people who say that cryptos are built on this very like useful and important technology, and that useful technology is going to come in and it's going to take over from bits of our financial system. So you should buy it for that reason, because, you know, it's about to get very important. And then there are other people who say, like, actually, nah, like, that's all nonsense. Like, the only reason that these things are going up is because some people are naive and other people are just greedy, and they're buying it because it has been going up. And that's what's driving it up. And I mean, in Dogecoin, you've kind of got this crypto which doesn't have any pretensions to be useful. It's just a joke. But nonetheless, it has gone from nothing to 90 billion. And it's sort of, in that sense, it's maybe a kind of a thumb in the eye of the very, very serious crypto people who want to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. And then over the weekend, we've all been reading and indeed talking this morning about the HSE ransomware hack, and Bitcoin was mentioned when people were talking about how much these people were looking for. There is an association when it comes to cryptocurrency and criminality.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, as I said, like, one of the arguments around cryptos is that they're going to be useful. And I mean, even skeptics of crypto have to concede that they are very useful for for example, extorting people, you know, trafficking drugs. Like, one thing that crypto has going for it is that it's anonymous. So you can, like, send money, like, anonymously around the world. No one ever needs to know about it. So you could, you know, you could hold the HSE to random, take your money, or to ransom, take your money, and no one would ever find out about it.
Yeah, and then on the Elon Musk side, I mean, the power that he has when he comments on cryptocurrency to alter the price dramatically. Now, I mean, it's one thing to ask whether it's responsible of him to do that, but it says a lot about the power of this one individual.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing. He comes up all over this thing. And, like, as I said, there's two ways of looking at this. And he sort of provides evidence for both arguments, because in one sense, he is the CEO of two extremely important companies. One is Tesla, the other is SpaceX. And in his capacity as CEO of Tesla, he said before in February that he would now start accepting Bitcoin in exchange for his cars. So, you know, when he did that, that sort of seemed to say something fundamental has changed about Bitcoin. And, like, maybe it means that, you know, maybe more CEOs are going to start doing this. Maybe this is the beginning of a snowball. Maybe Bitcoins are going to be used for all sorts of transactions soon. So, like, you know, in that way, you know, in a very fundamental way, he sort of seemed to be saying that that Bitcoins are going to go from the edge of the financial system into the center of the financial system. But so that was on the fundamental side. But then the other thing about Elon Musk is that he's kind of like an attention seeker. He's a bit of a prankster. He doesn't take things very seriously. And he's got this huge fat following. And he likes to just, like, mess around on Twitter. And in that capacity, when he steps up out of nowhere and says Dogecoin is the people's crypto. And that just sends Dogecoin absolutely flying. So, you know, he feeds into both narratives. He says both that crypto could be something very useful and important, and also that crypto is not really to be taken seriously and it's just a pure speculation.
And is there any consensus around crypto? I mean, what is it going to become?
Oh, that's a difficult question. The thing about crypto, the reason that's very good for accepting ransoms is that it's decentralized. And that means that there is no, like, central server somewhere, anywhere in the world that, like, where all the transactions run through. Instead of that, the transactions are spread across the entire world. And so that's good because it means that the governments can't get involved, but it's bad if you're actually trying to do something practical, like, you know, for example, right, if you're Visa, you know, manages transactions all over the world. And Visa doesn't do it on that basis. Visa has one central server at the center. It's much, much faster. It's much more efficient. Everything goes through that. Cryptos, by comparison, because they're decentralized, they're much less efficient. And that limits their usefulness for practical purposes.
Sean Keyes, finance correspondent with Claire Byrne in the morning. And in the morning, Shannon Joyce joined Ryan Tuberty on the line with some good news.
So the other day I had a scan, well, last week I had a scan for my 100 days post stem cell transplant and it came back all clear. So I have no evidence of disease in my body at the moment, no cancer cells, and long may that last.
This must feel so strange and wonderful.
Oh, absolutely. Especially because the last couple of weeks after the transplant, I've been finding the recovery pretty hard, and like I just wasn't feeling great. So when you're not feeling great and you always get bad news, you're kind of expecting bad news. So when they called to say scan is absolutely perfect, it's just, I actually couldn't talk. It was just so overwhelming.
And what do you do with that news, Shannon? I mean, when you're after all this time and all this bad news, and when you suddenly get this good news, and with restrictions lifting and a sense of normality returning to the world, how are you feeling?
To be honest, it's just like I just wanted to get home because obviously I'd been living in Dublin since February. I was in hospital for 9 weeks. So when we got the news, like it wasn't, I didn't want to go doing this big celebration or going out or anything like that. I just wanted to get home, back to my own comfort, spending time with Barry and Roisin, and just you take the little things for granted. And I just wanted to get back to doing the small, normal little mammy things that I was always used to doing.
Shannon Joyce on the Ryan Tuberty Show. And on today with Claire Byrne to discuss the situation in Gaza, John Simpson, the BBC World Affairs editor.
So there was a theory towards the end of last week that the Eid holiday might provide some respite, but the fighting just seems to have become more intense over the last number of days.
Well, there's a pattern to these things, you know. This is scarcely the first
example of this that we've had, and you can see a clear kind of graph that goes through them. Israel attacks Gaza City in particular in response to Hamas rockets. And the way in which the thing goes, the international community starts to get upset by the loss of life and the appalling conditions that are exerted on civilians. And eventually they force a ceasefire. And we're kind of, I think, two-thirds of the way through this at the moment. Israel actually ramping up its attacks, but in the knowledge that quite soon the Americans, who are really at the moment their only strong supporters internationally, will say to them, look, you can't keep on doing this, you've got to stop. And then there'll be some form of ceasefire negotiations. It's a depressing pattern.
Mm-hmm. And as you say, we're not at the end of it yet. I see your own, the BBC's diplomatic correspondent, Paul Adams, saying that Hamas has been offering some kind of ceasefire for several days. Israel, though, wants to keep going until the it's finally brought to a close. And you, as you say, this follows this pattern where Israel rebuffs any attempt to reach a ceasefire point because it needs to inflict as much damage as it feels it needs to in order to reach a point where this ceasefire will be successful.
That's exactly the purpose of it. I mean, Israel says its purpose is to destroy Hamas as much as it can. Hamas says that 20 of its fighters, including some one or two quite senior people, have been killed. And the Israelis say that it's far worse than that. And I dare say it is. The trouble is that you've got Gaza City, which is packed out with around 600,000 people. It's the third most densely populated city on Earth. And if you use high explosive, no matter how carefully targeted in a city that densely populated, you're going to cause an awful lot of civilian casualties. And it looks as though something like 200 Palestinians have been killed, including 55 children and 33 women so far.
What happens, John? I mean, do we just go through this cycle we saw in 2014, and people are already comparing it to then and saying perhaps this could be worse because of the level of rocket attacks and back and forth? I mean, how is this pattern disrupted? Can it be?
Well, I mean, it will. I don't think it can be interrupted because I think Israel is determined not to let up until it's got something of what it wants.
John Simpson from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Playback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.